Welcome back to Jazz for the Asking, Hour 2. We continue this hour featuring the man and the music of Mr. Willis Conover. We're going to be joined in a moment with a personal friend of Willis Conover, Marie Chiliberti. But first, here's Ella Fitzgerald and When Your Lover Has Gone.
When you're alone, who cares for starlit skies? When you're alone, the magic moonlight dies. At break of dawn, there is no sunrise. When your lover has gone, what lonely hours the evening shadows bring. What lonely hours with memories lingering. Like faded flowers, life can't mean anything when your lover has gone.
Surprise to Willis that his program, truthfully, had the impact that it did. He had no way of knowing, of course, the impact he would have on Eastern Europe, the Baltics, USSR, Cuba. And it hit him in 1959, and it's described in a Reader's Digest article about his trip to Poland. And he used to be one of his favorite stories, but when he came to Poland they were out on the tarmac, he saw these crowds and he thought maybe there was some dignitary from the Communist Party on the plane or something that they were greeting. There were people holding up banners and he just didn't know. As he came out, there was a band that started playing, Dixieland. He said, "What is this?" It was for him. And when he went to go into Warsaw, they had kids on motorcycles and scooters that were escorting him into the city as if he was some potentate or some huge figure. He had no idea at that time. It hit him again when my report came from the Soviet Union, from the exhibit. And I think that he had had about 6 letters at the time from USSR, and they'd have to be smuggled out. There probably were thousands, and they never let them come through. So they had no idea. Here in D.C., had no idea of the impact that his programs had in the Soviet Union. We would have people come up and say, I speak English because I listen to Willis Connor on the radio. He is hero. I said, that's wonderful. You know, I didn't know who he was. They could have come up and said, do you know Joe Blow? No, is he from Tokyo? I don't know. But I did get into this mystical connection that he had with them. I can remember in Tbilisi walking up this street, you know, because it's mountainous and they have, you know, very hilly streets. And we were walking up this crooked street in Tbilisi, and it was a hot summer evening. And from every window, his program was playing. And it was like hearing it in stereo. And we're walking up this thing, and I think it was Ellington that was playing. And by the time, and all these people in all these houses were listening to Willis Conover's program. I think it was at 11 o'clock at night. It was late. But I'll never forget that sensation. And a group of jazz musicians in Moscow drove me outside of the city and picking me up in a car and then putting me in another car. And we ended up at the Meat and Milk Institute. What the heck was it? And there assembled was a jazz quartet. And they played a concert for me. And they said for me to go back and tell them how they love Willis Conover. This is what I found. And as I said, back here in D.C., which I found out later after I met Willis Conover, and they were talking about taking his program off the air because they said, should we be entertaining people in the Soviet Union with this music called jazz? So, as I said, if you talk about research or guides for programming, you have to be there. You have to talk to people there. And you in a communist society, they are more reluctant to tell you, except the ones that, as we found, during that time, they had what they called the golden youth, Zolotaya Molodyozh, that were all tuned into things that were Western. They had people, they had guys walking around like the Beat Generation. So it was an incredible time of my life, and of course it changed me forever because I did study with Willis Conover. He was a teacher, and he taught me everything. I used to go and listen to his programs in the studio when Stan Getz used to come in, or Louis Armstrong used to come in, or Woody Herman, or any of the ones come in for an interview. He'd call me up on the phone. He'd say, come on, Stan Getz is here. And this is my education. So then after I came back, because of this incredible popularity of his show, we did play Willis Conover's show at the end of the Russian programming. It went on about 1 or 2 in the morning, in which we would translate some of the things he said. Mm-hmm. Later on, I was very fortunate to do a Conversations with Conover show with him, which went on for 10 years, which was a departure from his usual. I mean, he was meticulous. He listened to every single thing. He constructed the entire program. This kind of thing that you think, oh, well, it's just a jazz show. I pull out an album and I put it on the air. No, nothing like that. He was, and as far as timing was concerned, textures were concerned, how one melody went to the other, there was a total method in this madness of putting together the show. Our show was improvisational. I'd walk in the studio, he'd say, pack of records. I think maybe we can take this, this, and this. And then in the middle of the show, he would think about something else, and then we'd go off into something else. And it was like sitting across from an encyclopedia of jazz. And we got him, you know, on tape. I took the program back, and then I redid it, translated it into Russian, got a voice to simulate the same kind of conversation that we had in English to be in Russian. So Willis was always when I did research on his biography in the National Archives, he had done a series of television things for television. He had videos in which he interviewed Red Norvo or at the Baird Auditorium, and he was already branching out at that time because he knew that there was something else. So he was always very conscious of that and did not want to just stay in the one comfortable place where he was. That's why he would go to cover concerts. The Newport Jazz Festival concerts were amazing. He went out to the universities and to Towson and to North Texas State, which has most of his papers right now because he had a special love for them, and University of Illinois, John Garvey, and would do different things, not just the records. He would do interviews, his memorable interview with Irving Berlin, with Bill Evans. So there was always a thing of not being staying in one place and branching out. When he did the Russian language show with me, he branched out to the Polish service, and a Polish lady did one with him, to the Romanian service, where Gabriela did one with him. So it was always in the thing of always searching for a new way of presentation.
There's a name that I'm going to mention who you may not know him. He went on the air by the name of Karl Yegorov. He was a broadcaster with Radio Moscow, and he did a show called Jazz Show. After the collapse of the Soviet Union and Radio Moscow became Voice of Russia, he started using his real name on the air, which was Carl Watts. And he continued doing Jazz Show. And I found out a couple of months ago that he was a listener of Willis's show when he was doing Jazz Show on Radio Moscow. And somebody that worked with Carl said, you know, he would record Jazz Show on a Wednesday. And where he was living in Moscow, because of the jamming, he couldn't hear it. But he had a cousin that lived outside of Moscow that would record it off the air on open reel tape, get the tape delivered to his house in Moscow. He would listen at home and then get ideas what he would do on his own show.
But that's the way that they used to listen also, mm-hmm. as many people found out when, based on information that we had given them, that they would go out to the dacha. They would go outside the city, and they would record it. And then they would make copies of it and give it to other people. They had an entire samizdat. Can you imagine people typing painstakingly Solzhenitsyn's novels and his works on a typewriter at all hours of the night just for this whole samizdat thing, and then they would go from one to the other, hand to the other? I mean, that's nothing that we have within our comprehension. Mm. We have nothing in our comprehension that the saxophone would have been banned by the Communist Party as a decadent instrument of the American bourgeoisie. Mm. What the hell does that mean? Excuse me, what the heck does that mean? But we here in America, don't, when you talk about it, it's like we're talking about the last trip that we made to Venus or Mars. But they were on our planet. And he did touch them, and it was almost like I've seen it described as a religious experience, and that he was a preacher, and that they listened to him and as an icon. Thank you.
What was Willis like? I mean, if you were just walking in the VOA, because from some interviews that I've seen of him, he seemed like a very modest person, and he seemed not quite sure how to take the celebrity that he had. Was he just like your... an ordinary person that you'd see in the hallway, not pretentious, and just go, "Hey, Willis, how you doing?" and just start talking?
He was a shy person, and introverted, and complex, and at the same time, very funny. As I said, very surprised by this, I don't want to say notoriety, but this incredible popularity, which he found that he had. So he's always very conscious also of what he said. He also talked slowly and in that measured tone and in that bass baritone voice. You know, so, I mean, you couldn't miss him in the hall. The people liked him, especially the people from the Eastern European services that knew of his great impact in the countries there. And they had a kind of idolatry kind of thing going with him, too. He was extremely well-read. He was very conscious of, the political landscape, even though there was never anything political that came into his programs, nothing, which was also astounding, because he became like an emblem for freedom, and it was not anything that was deliberate. He was an accidental celebrity, let's put it that way.
The show that he did for so many years is remembered by so many people around the world. It's astonishing because you just said, you know, he never touched on politics in the show. And you think about the impact and how it helped people with their struggle. That should be a message for us to use today.
Well, the astounding thing is that a number of musical children that he had throughout the world that said that his programs were the things that changed their lives. Valery Ponomaryov has written a book about that. My Sax Life with Paquito Di Rivera, mm-hmm. and Milcho Leviev. All these people in all different countries who had no connection with him whatsoever, with each other, were bound by Willis Conover. And I saw that in the commemorative concert that they had at the VOA when they used to commemorate Willis Conover. They don't do that very much anymore. Where we had Milcho Leviev and we had Valery Ponomaryov and Paquito, and that were playing the songs that they had heard on Willis Conover's show. Paquito left Cuba because of him. Adam Makowicz and the great Polish pianist, when you hear him talk, I mean, his eyes glaze over and he goes into this almost kind of trance-like thing of the effect that the program had on him. And he was a classical pianist. Many of the musicians in the Soviet Union came from a classical tradition. So technically, they knew what was being done on the instrument by John Coltrane. They knew what Charlie Parker was doing. They knew technically, although they couldn't make their instruments do the same thing because they didn't have the basic thing like reeds, okay? Mm-hmm. So, as I said, it was a very mystical thing which happened. Could it happen again, you asked? I don't know. In fact, I've thought about that. If Willis had been still alive, which, you know, he died when he was 75, but say that he had started later or someone had come up around him that was equivalent or anything, I don't know. I know that Willis wanted very badly to have Billy Taylor take over his program. He already knew, I guess, toward the last year or so, that he wasn't going to be here that long. He brought in Billy Taylor to meet the VOA director because he had wanted that tradition to continue, But, of course, Voice of America dropped it. When he died, poof, there went Willis Conover, poof, there went jazz. Could there have been a continuum? I don't know. We never will know, because they only got someone that does things on, I think it's on the weekends now. But to continue his tradition, nobody ever did it. Could it be revived? I don't know that. Willis always believed in one thing. He used to say about the musicians in the various countries that they would only be able to play jazz really from when they would call on their own tradition. That's why when there was a pianist from Azerbaijan, Vagif Mustafazadeh, that took the rhythms and the melodies of Azerbaijani music and their complex harmonic and rhythmic forms and wove them into jazz. He did his own compositions. Of course, he did have quite a knowledge about American jazz, but he always said they had to take it to the next step in this whole creative dynamic of creating their own. So maybe that was his role, to do it and to have the impact on those musicians so they could continue the tradition without depending on listening to American musicians. And that would have been the dream of Willis Conover that would have happened. So I don't know whether you could have anyone like him. I the mold is broken. He's gone.
After he passed away, VOA did continue to air the Jazz Hour for a little while. The shows that he did, because he did the series so long, does the series still exist, or were the tapes just discarded?
Oh, thank you for asking that. Thank the Lord, the National Archives grabbed those tapes, and they all have them in the National Archives, and they are transferring all of his programs. There are over 30,000 onto CDs with, you know, the identification of the musicians and when it was aired, etc. They are all there. They're sitting there. They're for the scholars of the future. That's where people will be. He's there. He's enshrined there. I'm going to call it artistry, because it was artistry what he did, because he could sometimes be a magician. It's all there. I'm very thankful for that. There was some battle about who owns them. Does VOA own them because he was a contract employee? Ergo, they must own them. Somehow there was some deal made, and I don't know all the particulars, but they were transferred to the National Archives. And they are slowly, because they don't have a lot of people that are working on it, because they have to depend on grants, et cetera, that are transferring these dusty tapes onto CDs so that people in the future can hear them.
Wonderful, it's marvelous, you should care for me. It's awful nice, it's paradise, it's what I love to see. You've made my life so glamorous. You can't blame me for feeling amorous. Oh, it's wonderful, it's marvelous that you should care for me. that you should care, that you should care for me. It's awful nice, paradise. It's what I love to see. You've made my life so glamorous. You can't blame me for feeling amorous. It's wonderful, it's marvelous that you should care for me.
I've heard that technicians that worked with Willis, and this, don't forget, is the days when they were still using vinyl discs. They would spend a lot of time on each vinyl disc to make sure that there were no cracks or anything or any type of noise that would take away from the program. He was so... For him, it was so important to put the best quality sounding show on the air. And this of course is going out on shortwave. Is that true, that so much care would be, you know, put into the show, even just from a technical aspect?
Absolutely. He had the best engineers in the building. The best engineers would be assigned to his program, and many of them stayed for big chunks of time, and as they were recognized as the best. I mean, because you have people who are, you know, good, bad, and indifferent. He had the best. And no pop would ever go on his program. In fact, he taught me how to take out the pops. And his engineers worked, painstakingly, in order that quality be absolutely perfect. Yes. Yes, that's absolutely true. So as I said, when I've talked to some people, they say, oh, well, you do a music show. Well, you just grab a bunch of discs and you go into the studio. Sorry, not so.
I think that today, if Willis was doing a show and, you know, he was using vinyl in the 1990s when he passed away, what he would think of the new technology that we have now with CDs, where you don't have to worry about that.
Right. Well, as I said, then it wouldn't be necessary to have the very, very best radio techs that were working on your program. And I think by the end, the CDs were already coming in. He died in 1996.
Mm-hmm. When he passed away, just before he passed away, the show itself, I mean, would he record the show in one single take, or was every show recorded in pieces and then put together by an engineer?
I think maybe toward the end it was done that way. When I met him in all those years, he would be in the studio and he would be listening, because that way he would know whether there was a pop, okay, or whether the quality. He would stop something right in the middle and say, no, we can't go with this. We'll have to go with something else. So he would be in, because he spent incredible hours in the studio. And, you know, from the time he came in, and he was always very punctual. He was never one of these people that would come in at 12, you know, kind of in, you know, until 6 or whatever. I mean, he would be there on time and stay until 5 or 6 or 7 at times in the studio while the program was being done. Maybe toward the end, they would take his voice tracks and then put them, you know, with the music, do it in that way. But I didn't know that part. So
how long did he continue doing the show after he was diagnosed with cancer?
Oh, that I don't remember. It was sometime in the 80s. You know, he worked until I think the last week before he died. I think he was only in the hospital for several days and passed away. I'm trying to think of the exact date. It was in the 80s when he had the operation and when they found out that he had cancer. And of course, you know, he suffered with that because it destroyed his salivary gland. So he, you know, he had to use a special spray in order to, you know, to keep you know, his, you know, mouth lubricated. So there were a lot of physical strains that went with it. The pipes didn't start to go until the very end. And you can tell already. I heard one of his last programs that he had done for VOA Europe at the time, and it was painful. It was painful. So,
but had it been announced that he was ill, or was this something that the VOA just kept quiet about?
Well, they had really no reason to publicize the fact that he was. I mean, he was a contract employee too, mm-hmm. you know, all those years, and for a very, very real reason, and that is which he told me, and I'm going to share with you because he's not here anymore, is that he didn't want any bureaucrats, and he changed one of the letters in bureaucrats, the T, when he described them, of telling him what he could or could not do on the program, and what musicians were verboten, what he, as I said, to have control of the product. And of course this hurt him, because then he couldn't get the benefits. He couldn't get holidays, he couldn't get overtime, he couldn't get medical coverage, all the other things. But he was very adamant about that, that, you know, it, times might be good where people would be supportive of him, but there were other people that for no reason at all would become his enemy and would want his program taken off the air, you see? And that's was the basis for that decision. And there was one incident that he told me when he was playing Albert Mangelsdorf, you know, the German trombonist, mm-hmm. and that would go into these, you know, things, and there would be silence, and then he'd come out with a boom. One person, according to what Willis said, went running into the program manager and said, "Put on the Stroger, put on the Stroger, listen to what he's playing now." And he said, "He's going to blow out the transmitter." So, anyway, that was his decision, and he never wavered from it. So, that was the reason. Thank you.
The music we were listening to, The Cat, Jimmy Smith. The fantastic vocals of Joe Williams and Sir Wonderful. And the Maynard Ferguson Dream Band with Blue Birdland. We heard the interview that I did with Marie Chiliberti, a personal friend of Willis Conover, on this special edition of Jazz for the Asking, from PCJ Radio. In a moment, I'm going to give you our email address so you can contact us to let us know what you think of the program. But let's move to another artist that was featured frequently on Jazz on the Voice of America with Willis Conover, Dizzy Gillespie and Manteca. Manteca, Dizzy Gillespie. And guess what? We are out of time on this edition of Jazz for the Asking. If you enjoyed the program that you just heard, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is jazz@pcjmedia.com. You can also listen to this program again, as well as all past editions, by going to our website, www.pcjmedia.com, JFTA. To end off our tribute to Mr. Willis Conover, we're going to leave you with Mel Torme, with a track he recorded in London, Too Close for Comfort. So until next time, friends, this is Keith Parron saying so long and take care.
Be wise, be fair, be sure, be there, behave, beware. Be wise, be smart, behave, my heart. Don't upset your cart when she's so close. Be soft, be sweet, but be discreet. Don't go off your feet, she's too close for comfort. Too close for comfort, no, not again. Too close to know just when to say when. Be firm and be fair, be sure, beware. On your guard, take care when there's such temptation. One thing leads to another, too late to run for cover. She's much too close for comfort. Thinking cat boy, 'cause if you don't look out, you will find that you are much too close for comfort. You're heading for a mishap, boy. The first thing that you know, she will have you up that old tree. She's too close for comfort. Too close. Absolutely sure, beware. On your guard, take care when there is such temptation. One thing leads to another, too late to run for cover. She's much too close for comfort now. One thing leads to another, too late to run for cover. She's much too close for comfort now. One thing leads to another, too late to run for mother. She's much too close for comfort now. Be wise, be fair, be sure, be there, behave, beware. Too close for comfort now.